Donors are looking in how they can build on that plantation, on that forestry, and bring benefits back to the community.
Fighting climate change in Pakistan by planting trees. It's Friday, November 5th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Amy Heibels in Washington. You'll also find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, New Zealand researchers hope to use green hydrogen in Antarctica. What U.S. election results may mean for Biden's Build Back Better plan. Violence against nurses in the U.S. Wife of Canadian Uyghur imprisoned in China wants husband back. And concerns over Chinese fishing near Galapagos Islands. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Pakistan is one of the most vulnerable countries to climate change in the world. In order to defend against the destructive effects of a warming planet, the government plans to plant 10 billion trees by the year 2023. Shazib Jalani reports for VOA from the Mansehra district in North Pakistan.
Meet Asia Bibi, a mother of five. She, along with other family members, has been running this nursery in her backyard for 6 years. The project is part of the government's Green and Clean Pakistan campaign to plant more trees.
This is a lot of hard work, along with running the household and taking care of children. I attend to the seedlings a couple of hours in the morning and then in the afternoon every day. The challenge is to ensure they take root and do not die out.
Under the government's signature 10 billion tree project, the provincial forest department pays for the initial costs of the saplings. Months later, the plants are bought back by the government for reforestation. The income goes a long way to help Asia take care of her large family. As a result, Pakistan's forest cover has increased significantly. More than 3 billion trees have already been planted in the last 8 years, say officials.
Until a few years ago, these hills were completely barren. But thanks to the Billion Tree Tsunami project, the green cover has now been restored. Experts say it's easy to plant trees, but very difficult to ensure their long-term survival and protection.
Launched on a provincial level after 2013, the Billion Tree project expanded at a national level in 2018 because it was seen as a success, including in District Mansehra. However, illegal logging remains a big problem, along with forest fires and animal grazing. Under its Green Jobs initiative, thousands of forest guards have been hired from the community to protect the trees.
Many of these plants are very young. They are constantly under threat. We keep an eye on their survival and report any violations to the forest department.
But the project has not been without criticism. Political opponents have raised questions over transparency and accountability. Others have accused the government of mismanaging the plantation drive in early years and introducing exotic invasive species ill-suited for the region. Not so, says the man leading this initiative launched by the Prime Minister Imran Khan.
Well, 60% of this project even today is assisted natural regeneration. There's no chance of going and planting an invasive species over there. So it's just nature coming back with its own plants through its own process, but you are protecting it in an organized manner, and that's how it happens.
Most experts agree that despite initial obstacles, the country has shown a rare commitment to restore and expand its otherwise shrinking forest cover.
And yes, they achieved it, and I think what is happening now is donors are looking in how they can build on that plantation, on that forestry, and bring benefits back to the community, back to the forest department, back to Pakistan.
Back at the village, Asia Bibi is telling her daughters about the livestock she was able to buy from her nursery earnings. The family can only hope that the initiative will help lead to a greener, better tomorrow for future generations. Shazib Jalani, VOA News, District Mansehra.
We invite you to read more on our top story by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. Indian Muslims arrested for celebrating Pakistani cricket victory over India. Taliban size up threat from tenacious Islamic State Khorasan. Myanmar religious groups say they face persecution. China nuclear arsenal grows faster than previously thought, Pentagon says. Myanmar court denies bail for U.S. journalist Danny Fenster, adds new charge. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. A New Zealand research project is looking at ways to produce hydrogen in Antarctica to reduce carbon emissions. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports for VOA.
A four-month New Zealand project is investigating whether hydrogen could be generated, used and stored at Scott Base, its Antarctic research facility, to reduce its reliance on carbon-based fuels. Those fuels are currently used for transportation, cooking and heating. A special grade fuel is shipped in on icebreakers. Surplus power from wind turbines at Scott Base could be used to generate green hydrogen for hydrogen fuel cells that produce electricity by combining hydrogen and oxygen atoms. The Hydrogen Initiative is a collaboration between Antarctica New Zealand, a government scientific body, and the University of Canterbury in Christchurch. The project started in August and will finish this month. The project faces some obstacles, including geographic isolation and extreme weather. Antarctica is the coldest, windiest and driest continent. In 1983, a temperature of minus 89.2 degrees was recorded. Brendan Miller, a consultant chemical engineer, says it's an ambitious plan.
We'd like to demonstrate that we can use hydrogen effectively as a energy source to replace fossil fuels. It's a very challenging environment to do it in Antarctica, but actually there are some things going for it because the alternates, like batteries, are quite awkward to use for long-term storage, particularly at very cold temperatures.
New Zealand's work in Antarctica focuses in large part on global warming. Experts have said the world's southernmost continent was very sensitive to rising temperatures, and it also influenced the global climate system. Earlier this year, the New Zealand government said it would spend $200 million to guarantee the future of its scientific hub at Scott Base. Scientific projects in Antarctica are highly collaborative, bringing together researchers from around the world. 29 countries, including Australia, China and the United States, operate bases in Antarctica. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Still ahead on VOA Asia, U.S. Republicans won big this week in at least one off-year state election. What could it mean for the fate of U.S. President Joe Biden's Build Back Better Act? Happening now, Asia is finally starting to open up after many nations in the region imposed strict measures to combat the coronavirus pandemic. From Thailand to South Korea to Cambodia, Asian governments are relaxing social distancing rules and in some cases starting to welcome back foreigners. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. U.S. Republicans won big Tuesday in at least one off-year state election. As VOA's Carolyn Presutti reports, some see Democrats' losses in the U.S. state of Virginia as a warning sign for the party ahead of next year's midterm elections, when all seats in the U.S. House of Representatives and a third of the U.S. Senate will be up for grabs. Against this backdrop, U.S. President Joe Biden's Build Back Better plan remains stalled in Congress.
Two unwelcome surprises for Democrats. Republicans won the governor's race in Virginia for the first time in a decade with a candidate who has never held public office. Glenn Youngkin is Virginia's governor-elect.
All righty, Virginia, we won this thing!
And in New Jersey, Democratic Governor Phil Murphy won re-election, but in a much closer race that wasn't decided until Wednesday night.
Thank you, New Jersey! Thank you for putting your trust in our team for another 4 years.
In Virginia, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Terry McAuliffe tried to tie Youngkin to former President Donald Trump. He hoped to appeal to voters in a state that Democrat Joe Biden won by 10 points in the presidential contest. Republicans, meanwhile, focused on so-called kitchen table issues like taxes, education, and crime. Virginia's election results are a warning signal for Democrats, says Mark Roselle of George Mason University via Skype.
The public perception right now is that the Democrats who are in control of Washington can't get things done that they said they were going to do. and the Democratic brand is suffering.
Specifically, President Biden's Build Back Better Act. It would massively expand America's social safety net and combat climate change at a cost of $1.75 trillion. Here's what Biden said about it as Americans voted Tuesday.
It's going to lower inflation, raise wages, increase competition, create 2 million jobs a year.
But the bill remains stalled in Congress as progressive and moderate Democrats can't agree on its many provisions. Republicans seized on Tuesday's election results as evidence that Americans are rebelling against the plan. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell.
Democrats should listen to the voters. Drop this reckless taxing and spending spree and stop trying to ram through a socialist transformation that the American people never asked for.
But Democrats insist they will deliver on their promises to voters, including Build Back Better. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer.
The challenges American families and workers are facing today are enormous. And President Biden's agenda is the remedy to much of their hardships. It's just what the American people want and what they need.
Off-year elections are often perilous for the political party that controls Washington. Democrats have thin House and Senate majorities to defend in next year's midterm elections, which typically bring gains for the opposition party. Tuesday's results in Virginia added to Democrats' gloom and Republicans' budding optimism heading into 2022. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News.
Be sure to read and see more on this story at VOA Asia Facebook.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
From VOA Asia. The UN Refugee Agency this week began airlifting aid into Kabul for the first time since the Taliban overran the country, with a plane carrying 33 tons of supplies for displaced Afghans. Officials say much more is needed. All the important stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. Regularly cursed at and sometimes physically assaulted by patients, nurses in the United States have had enough. As VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias reports, the pandemic is accelerating a long-standing problem of violence against frontline healthcare workers.
Clipped to his ID badge, nurse Benjamin Koh has something extra, a panic button.
I've only been physically assaulted by a patient twice, but every single shift that I've ever worked as a nurse, at least one patient is going to use curse words at me, is going to make violent statements towards me.
Koh says the COVID-19 safety protocols aren't always welcome.
They're taking their frustration out on visitor policies and the vaccines, and the treatments have just been so over-politicized that it's politics at this point that's driving the problems.
A September survey from National Nurses United shows that 31% of hospital nurses experienced workplace violence, up more than a third since March. ICU nurse Mawata Kamara says a national nursing shortage is partly to blame.
We have more people getting agitated for things such like waiting too long in the emergency room. Unfortunately, the reality is I have other patients that are also equally sick, and I can only dedicate a certain amount of time to this patient.
After being assaulted, nurses can report what happened to supervisors or the police, but they don't always do so. On social media, however, they are not so shy. Doctor of Nursing Practice Sandra Rizzaldi is the founder of Nurses Against Violence Unite.
Nurses are afraid to report anything because of retaliation, because of feeling that like they're going to be blacklisted, or they're told by the facility not to make a report because of patient satisfaction scores.
That's where accountability breaks down. No reporting means attackers can get off scot-free. explains Richard Moreau of the Emergency Nurses Association.
We're up to approximately 31 states that have felony laws. So if you violently assault an emergency nurse, if you are convicted and it's a felony, it's generally a year of jail time or even more.
A proposed law in the U.S. Senate would require employers to protect nurses and others from reprisal for reporting abuse. It also mandates tailored prevention plans. The Maryland Hospital Association represents 53 hospitals and 7 health systems. In the last 5 years, its members have taken multiple steps to prevent workplace violence, said Bob Atlas, the association's CEO.
More cameras, more actual security guards, sometimes with canine.
But with all the politics in this pandemic, security only goes so far.
The nature of healthcare in a hospital is such that you can't eliminate the opportunity for harm. You've got to have caregivers and patients face-to-face.
Nurses like Kamara want a seat at the table when hospitals plan for safety.
Nurses don't want to quit, but if a nurse had to choose between, you know, keeping a job and coming home, you know, with a broken jaw or coming home traumatized every day, I think a lot of people would choose their peace of mind.
The more than 4 million registered nurses in the United States have shouldered a huge burden in the pandemic. A little help from their patients, they say, shouldn't be too much to ask. Veronica Valderas Iglesias for VOA News, Washington.
Making headlines in Asia, undeterred by the recent deaths of civilians and migrant workers, the Jammu and Kashmir administration has signed a pact with the Dubai government for the development of various infrastructure projects across the region. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the wife of a Uyghur Canadian is fighting to get her husband released after he was deported to China while visiting his wife's family in Uzbekistan. After the release of two Canadians from Chinese detention in September, Hussein Jalil's wife has fresh hope she might see her husband again. VOA's Laurel Bowman reports.
The wife of naturalized Canadian citizen Hussein Jalil says she hasn't seen her husband in 15 years. Jalil, who is Uyghur, is in a Chinese prison for charges related to his support of the rights of the Muslim minority group in northwest China. He was arrested in his wife's native Uzbekistan and deported to the People's Republic.
Since 2006, which is the arrested him, I haven't seen him, I haven't talked to him. How am I going to have a chance to meet with him? I haven't seen him since 2006.
She and her husband became naturalized Canadian citizens in 2005. She now lives in Burlington, Ontario, where the couple's 4 sons also reside. One son has a disability. Jalil's wife says her hopes were renewed when China released 2 Canadian citizens in September, Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor, at the same time that Canada released Chinese citizen and Huawei executive Ming Wangzhou to the People's Republic.
We have seen the proof. They got deal with China. They brought them home to Canada, to Michael's. So that's my hope, you know. They're going to do more for my husband to bring him home.
But experts say that China refuses to recognize Jalil's Canadian citizenship. Citizenship was not a major factor in the September release of the two Michaels. Guy Sanjak was the Canadian ambassador to China from 2012 to 2016 and worked on Jalil's case.
The key question is, for us, of course, he is a Canadian citizen, but China has always refused to recognize his citizenship. They said that he had acquired this citizenship illegally, despite the fact that, in fact, he followed all due process, met Canadian requirements to get his citizenship. He even renounced his Chinese citizenship because he had informed the Chinese embassy. But, of course, this is another example of China doing what it wants.
St. Jacques and other diplomatic experts call on China to give the Canadians access to Jalil Amnesty International urges China to return him to Canada.
It would certainly be the right thing for China to do. China's standing in Canada has suffered huge harm over the imprisonment of the two Michaels, but also over the imprisonment of Mr. Jalil. You don't see a story on China these days without mention of Mr. Jalil. And it's going to be an ongoing thorn in China-Canadian relations.
Meanwhile, Jalil's wife waits and worries.
So where is he? Is he alive or what? That's what, you know, my big concern.
The Chinese embassy has not responded to VOA's request for comment on the case. Laurel Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
In other news, Indians across the country began celebrating Diwali, the Hindu festival of lights, on Thursday, amid concerns over the coronavirus pandemic and rising air pollution. Many light oil lamps or candles to symbolize a victory of light over darkness, and fireworks are set off as a part of the celebrations. Last year, celebrations in India were upended by a renewed spike in COVID-19 infections, but festivities this year seem to have resumed. The Galapagos Islands off the Pacific coast of Ecuador teem with marine life, including endangered species. There are concerns over fishing by China's fleet near the islands. Jaime Moreno has this report for VOA.
Walter Borbor lives on the Galapagos Islands. A fourth-generation fisherman, he sees his livelihood threatened by hundreds of Chinese ships casting for squid near Ecuador's Galapagos Marine Reserve.
They catch tons of fish on those vessels. Large ships carry countless species, and this is large-scale exploitation. Fishing with this many ships is going to cause an irreparable impact. Some endangered species will come extinct.
Scientists studying evolution and the impacts of climate change value the isolated Galapagos Islands. Home to some 3,500 species, the islands almost 1,000 miles from South America's Pacific coast are a UNESCO biosphere reserve. But just beyond the boundaries of the reserve, Chinese fishing fleets are waiting.
As no one knows how much they catch, as there are no observers on board, there is no independent external audit, there is no data. Nobody knows what impact this has or whether it should be restricted or, if it isn't, what will happen.
China accounts for more than a third of global fish consumption. With waters overfishing Asia and demand rising, China's government-subsidized fleet, the world's largest, is now fishing off Latin America, Africa, and even Hawaii.
They have already finished with their resources in their seas, and they are cleaning out the rest of the ocean. They are in international waters, and they are legally fishing.
Last year, from July 13 to August 13, researchers spotted nearly 300 Chinese vessels near the Galapagos Reserve, going after squid, essential food for fur seals and scallop hammerhead sharks. Both are endangered species, endemic to the Galapagos. In 2017, authorities caught a Chinese vessel inside the reserve. More than 7,500 death sharks filled its hull. Most were hammerheads, but there were endangered silky, treasure, and mako sharks too. All value for Chinese medicinal and culinary use. China's ambassador to Ecuador, Chen Guoyu, told VOA that his government is acting to protect endangered species.
The Chinese government strictly prohibits all boats from fishing for protected and endangered marine species, and it has zero tolerance policy for undeclared illegal operations by fishing boats.
Ecuador has expressed its concern about the fleet, but believe international organizations should handle this issue.
Ecuador has worked on this topic and raised its concern. We have to work within and with the instruments that international law and current international agencies grant us.
Borbor worries the scale of Chinese fishing will affect the ocean food chain and the supply of fish resources.
On the mainland, for the past two decades, there haven't been enough fish close to shore for the artisanal fishers to catch. I don't want the same thing to happen here in two decades.
That was Jaime Moreno reporting for VOA. You have been listening to VOA Asia. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Keith Lane, Chris Coscao, Jessica Stone, and Jim Stevenson. I'm Amy Heibels in Washington. Now go and make it a great day.